Hello and welcome to the A Perspective with me, Andrew Skipper. I'm head of the Africa practice for international law firm Hogan Lovells and a member of the UK government's Africa Investors Group. I'm passionate about doing business in Africa and providing legal support for companies who are invested in the continent's future. Through these podcasts, I'll be exploring how business and government are working together in Africa, particularly as we navigate a way through the COVID-19 pandemic. So what are the risks for Africa as it grapples with the economic and health challenges of this virus? My guest today is Ronak Gopaldas. Ronak is a director at Signal Risks, a business that specializes in risk management on the African continent. Previously, he was at RMB as head of country risk. He's a regular and forthright media commentator on the continent. Welcome, Ronak.
Thank you very much for having me, Andrew.
It's a pleasure. Looking at what you're doing at the moment, assessing risk in Africa at any time is a challenge. Are you having to recalibrate your antennae in a time of COVID where basically one big issue is dominating everything else?
Pretty much, yeah. This COVID-19 pandemic has kind of overtaken everything else, and everything is pretty much linked to it. We're looking at the derivative effects on the kind of first, second, third round orders. We're looking at the political, economic, geopolitical fallouts. So it's been extremely busy, and I guess now it's time to shine as a risk analyst. It really is something out of an episode of Black Mirror. It does seem like we're approaching Groundhog Day, but for our clients, it's very much a case of providing guidance, providing clarity, and helping them navigate this phase.
I know you well, and you like bold statements. How do you find the right tone and balance in these difficult times in order to just get the right balance of risk?
It's a difficult one because the news cycle is evolving so fast. Nobody really knows with conviction what's going on. And, you know, I think we need to embrace the concept of epistemic humility, which I think is being okay with not knowing everything. This is a complex issue. It's got multidimensional layers. And our role is to help filter through the noise and understand the news and provide a framework to provide clarity and to provide comfort and insight to help our clients make more informed business decisions, not just in terms of the here and now, but also with an eye on the future. A lot of companies at the moment are very much in survival or firefighting mode. A lot of companies need to get on with the maintenance work, doing what they're good at doing, but also keep one eye on the future. And that's, I think, we're assisting in getting that balance right.
There is a real danger, I guess, in all these crises of just saying, we've got to sort this crisis out. I mean, how would you advise? I mean, we spoke the other day about how you might, an organization should address that, expanding the point you've just made, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the seeds of the next crisis are always sown in the current recovery. You know, I was told that by an ex-boss, and I think that's extremely true. And, you know, what medicine we're applying at the moment, both kind of literally and metaphorically, is going to be worth watching. You know, I've drawn the analogy of governments at the moment being in a triathlon of governance. We're in the Olympics of crisis management, and they've got to manage the healthcare issues, the economic issues, and the political issues simultaneously. Now, there's no precedent for this. They're learning as they're going, and in an era of largely populist leadership and isolationist policies rather than multilateralism, that is making a bad situation even worse. So, you know, we're in a position now where we need better leadership. We need to see cooperation, and you know, we in an African context, what we really need to see is coordination as well. Some countries on the continent have been better than others in managing the crisis, but the fallout is also going to be worth watching, particularly on the economic front.
And which countries do you think, I mean, picking up your triathlon point, which African countries are heading for gold and which are heading for being knocked out in the first round?
There's some good, some bad, and some ugly. I think Mauritius is a standout small island economy, but very, very proactive in the way that it's managed the crisis. And I think no new cases now for 3 weeks, and they're kind of looking to open up at the end of the month. South Africa has drawn praise from the World Health Organization for its evidence-based approach towards the public health aspect of the crisis. It's been proactive. It's had kind of some of the most severe measures in the world, but generally by going on that scientific path and being proactive, it's managed to mitigate some of the effects. I think Senegal's also done quite well. They began planning their response earnestly in January. As soon as the first international alert went out, the government closed borders, initiated a complex, comprehensive plan of contact tracing. And because of the nation's multiple occupation households, it offered a bed for every single coronavirus patient in either a hospital or a community health facility. So those are some of the, I guess, positive stories. Yeah. But then you've had some truly outlandish stuff as well. I mean, John Magufuli in Tanzania is kind of the poster child of how not to manage a public health crisis. He's put kind of the solution in trust of God. You know, religious gatherings, mass gatherings have not been banned in Tanzania. He said things like trust God, not the mask, and really just completely thrown out the handbook in terms of a scientific evidence-based approach towards managing this crisis, which has drawn criticism from the likes of the WHO. And then, of course, in Madagascar, you've got this herbal remedy, you know, Herbalife 2.0, whatever you want to call it, which has not gone through rigorous scientific tests, but is being kind of put forward as a silver bullet and an African solution to an African problem, which you know, is pretty dangerous given the lack of science behind it. So generally, you know, from a country-specific perspective, a bit of a mixed bag. But what has been quite impressive is what we've seen from regional and continental bodies. So the AU has been quite decisive in that regard. You know, there's the Africa CDC reacted quite early as February, in terms of offering technical, operational, and logistic supports to countries in need. It convened a meeting with all of the health ministers, particularly in the weaker countries. So that was proactive. The AU, through Cyril Ramaphosa, has been quite decisive, particularly on the debt side of things, where it sent through a team to go and negotiate with Africa's international creditors in order to ensure that the financial effects do not amplify and create a humanitarian catastrophe.
Yeah, I think I'm picking up on that last point, maybe, and the points you make about South Africa. I mean, South Africa has been praised a lot, but now there seems to be a political element coming into this, in which people are now saying, you've got to get us back, because you've got an informal economy, you've got with people earning day by day. So how do you turn round and get people back to work without causing political and health problems?
That's the million-dollar question. I mean, you know, and unfortunately, the discourse in South Africa has become quite binary. So, you know, the way it's being framed is people or the economy or lives or livelihood, yeah, or lockdowns or contact tracing and testing. And the reality, it's not either or, it's both and, which I think is really important. You're right, it has taken a political dimension after the initial strong start, where President Ramaphosa was able to kind of provide calm and assurance to the nation and really get people to rally around through decisive leadership. The contradictions in some of the execution and some of the underwhelming economic measures has kind of offset some of that credibility. But, you know, I think the reality is that they're trade-offs, and there's no perfect solution, and these solutions need to be customized to specific contexts. In a South African context, the economy wasn't doing well before the pandemic, and what the crisis has done is kind of, you know, really created a triple whammy of shocks, which is exacerbating a lot of these problems. You know, you've had massive capital flight as a result of emerging market risk aversion, commodity prices are down, and of course, a lot of the limited fiscal resources are now having to be diverted towards healthcare spending and stimulus packages to support the most needy in society. So this is the really difficult balancing act.
People have been saying, well, the crisis, all crises, there's opportunities. And they're saying to me, well, in Africa, the opportunities are to make changes, get things right. And they're saying that particularly in South Africa. Do you think that's a rational proposition?
So I agree with the sentiment that there's opportunity in crisis, but that we can reimagine the world in a different way. I think that's contingent really on being creative and being and the leadership that we have. So I think, you know, this does offer an opportunity to really reset a lot of things. And we're seeing some positive signs, you know, in terms of the collaboration between the public and the private sector in South Africa, where, you know, you've had a social compact being formed where business is working together with government in order to address big societal issues. I think, you know, South Africa being one of the most unequal countries in the world, this has really held up a mirror and exposed some of the issues. And it just shows that the current system that we have is not sustainable. So, you know, a shift, I think, in the business world from shareholder value to stakeholder value, and combining the two of these philosophies is something that I think will become quite apparent. You know, in crises, you also get innovation driven by necessity, which I think is something on a Pan-African level that we're seeing. You know, you've got companies like Zipline, which are, you know, using drones for innovative healthcare solutions. And then, you know, as I've said, the other issue that's impressed me quite a bit is this collective leadership on a regional level that Africa is showing, recognizing that its strength is in numbers. And it's able to have a much louder voice in terms of international affairs if it adopts a common position.
Yeah, and you don't think that all this potential positivity will be drowned in a sea of debt?
So the debt issue is a huge issue, and it's a massive dilemma. You know, in the context of the negative shocks that we've seen in financial markets, you had instances of a few weeks ago of Zambia, for example, paying 75% on its in terms of its debt servicing on its 2022 Eurobond. Mm. Quite clearly, that's unsustainable. And what it comes down to for these countries who have been affected by the economic shock is choosing between spending on healthcare or choosing between, you know, paying their creditors. And most governments, when faced with that situation and based on the domestic political dynamics, will choose to spend on their domestic priorities. So this is creating a bit of an issue, because on the current course, there are three options on the table. So number one is a default, where countries simply don't have the revenues. Number two is a restructure of the debt, where tenors are elongated and the terms are altered. But that's not particularly easy, just given some of the bureaucratic hurdles. And we've seen that in the instance of Mozambique. And then the third option, which is what the likes of Tijantiam have suggested, is a debt standstill or moratorium, given the fact that this was an external shock and that most African countries are helpless and have limited policy war chests to combat this. So the problem, though, comes on two fronts. And you've got the issue of moral hazard, particularly for private creditors, who will say that a lot of these African sovereigns had been misbehaving, not being prudent with their finances, and they're using this as a get-out-of-jail-free card. Then you have the counter argument, which could be put forward by a lot of African governments, which would say that by insisting that on these payments, you will effectively have blood on your hands and preside over a humanitarian catastrophe. And this is where I think the collective bargaining position has been very savvy, the use of moral suasion to kind of put forward a collective African position around this issue. It's complex, it's murky, there's going to be resistance from the side of private creditors. The other issue is the issue of Chinese debt, and there's a bit of reticence there as well. But I think what's quite clear is that there's going to need to be a pragmatic compromise over here, because otherwise it ends up being the equivalent of a bar fight and with negative outcomes for all parties. So
yeah, and do you see a reassessment of the China-Africa relationship coming out of this? Or will it be same as it was before?
So that's a really good question. And there have been a few recent developments which have really shone the spotlight on this. So, you know, there's been the xenophobic attacks of African students in Guangzhou province in China, which has really created a strong backlash, both diplomatically and emotionally, around the treatment of Africans in China, and that has posed questions around whether there's going to be an economic fallout as a result of this. Then, you know, China's management of the virus has raised questions, and a lot of Africans feel aggrieved that they're suffering as a result of China's mismanagement and their lack of transparency. And then you have a narrative forming around the issue of reparations. The likes of Obi Ezekwesili in Nigeria are pushing the view that China should pay Africa reparations. Now, you know, that's all kind of created a bit of acrimony and a bit of tension. I think China will pull its economic and diplomatic levers to smooth that out, even though it might need to focus more on its domestic economy in the short term. I don't think it's going to cede the ground that it's built in terms of the geostrategic and geoeconomic relations with Africa that it's built over the past few decades. It's not going to leave a vacuum for other players like the US to exploit. And Africa needs China, and China needs Africa. So I think, you know, the Chinese tend to play chess in terms of their international relations, and they're in it for the long haul. So I think there's an opportunity here to recalibrate the relationship, where the relationship can become a much more even and a much more fair relationship. You know, we've had allegations of debt trap diplomacy in the past around exploitation of Africa by China. Now, with a shift away from Chinese supply chains, could there be opportunities for Africa? That's another question in terms of the manufacturing and agricultural space. So I definitely think it will evolve, but I don't know if there's going to be a radical shift.
You're an African living at the moment in London. Do you think opinion outside, because a lot of the things we're talking about, you might apply elsewhere in the world. Do you think opinion outside Africa about Africa is inaccurate and unfair, given the relative lack of cases at the moment and the promptness with which some countries have already addressed the crisis?
It's a bit more nuanced than that. I think, you know, there is a tendency to sell Africa as this basket case of poverty, disease and destruction in the Western media. But I think in terms of this crisis, there are a lot of reasons that have been put forward as to why Africa has been relatively more resilient. You know, amongst these are the climate, the fact that African countries have some kind of history and are used to dealing with chronic disease outbreaks, and then also the fact that Africa's got a much younger population. But you know, I think timing is also a major issue in this regard, where the virus hit Africa a lot later than it did many other parts of the world. So that created the capacity to prepare, to test, and to get on the front foot in many instances, and to have proactive lockdowns. The other issue is, of course, the issue of reporting and testing. You know, the stats in Africa are significantly lower than many parts of Europe and in the States. As a result, you don't really know where you stand. It could be a case of many of the cases being underreported. I think, you know, the fear is that there's an element of calm before the storm, where, you know, if you look at the capacity to contain the virus, is very limited, both on the healthcare resources and in terms of the financial resources. Yeah. So, you know, I do think we've had a lot of positive elements in terms of the management of the crisis. Africa has in many parts proven more resilient and more innovative in its responses. But I wouldn't get too excited just yet, because I do think we haven't seen the last of this pandemic.
But are there any silver linings from your point of view for the continent in this?
Yeah, I think I touched on a few of them a little bit earlier. I think it just offers an opportunity to reset the system. You know, I think in one sense, Africa needs to really disrupt itself. You know, the kind of issue of public officials traveling to Europe for medical treatment, now that's no longer on the table. So that forces them to confront the reality of their creaking healthcare systems. It forces them to actually govern, which is something that has been underwhelming in an African context for a long time. And as we saw through the Ebola crisis, you know, there's also the issue of investment in healthcare infrastructure and capacity could leave lasting legacy benefits. I'm quite excited about the possibility of a collective and regional African position and greater regional cooperation. And I think, you know, what is quite exciting, even though it's been postponed, is the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. So, yeah. You know, in an era of where we're likely to see heightened isolationism and nationalism, and where capitalism needs reform, I think two counter trends are emerging, and that is the issue of digitization and the issue of localization. So I think, you know, the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement offers an opportunity really to kind of catalyze e-commerce, to look at issues of food security. And with many Western partners and other partners for the African continent dealing with their domestic issues, you might see foreign aid and foreign investment slow down, which means that Africa needs to help itself and apply African solutions to African problems. And, you know, trading with each other is probably the easiest way to do that. Intra-Africa trade at the moment is only 18%. So for me, that's the low-hanging fruit. And, you know, if we can get the political leadership right, and if we can understand that that the solutions lie within the continent, I think that is potentially a quite exciting opportunity.
Thank you. And I think with African solutions for African problems, I think Ronak Gopaldas of Signal Risks, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for your time on the A Perspective.